Okay, so we're going to talk about chapter 9, and this is really talking about staff and family support, and abuse and neglect prevention. And I have to tell you, as an elder law attorney, there's so much of this today. I'm sure many of you are in positions where you see this. You see neglect, you see abuse. It's really hard. And so I want to spend some time on this. So, first of all, we want to think about the fact that caregiving is such a hard job. And particularly if I'm being asked to caregive for somebody who, it's hard and I don't have a lot of support. And so on here, it talks about they're at risk for these things. What I can tell you is that there are statistics that show that somebody who is a caregiver for somebody with dementia is greatly affected. So my husband cared for his dad for his dad had dementia for 14 years. He cared for his dad during that time, and statistically, he will have lost 5 years off of his life expectancy. So if you look into the statistics for caregiving for children, child caregivers, and spousal caregivers, the accumulated ongoing stress definitely has an effect, a long-term effect. So what can we do to intervene? I think again, at my office, we're trying to make the dementia journey slightly easier. We can't change the journey, but really supporting people, validating their feelings, letting them know that it's okay to say this sucks, this is hard, instead of like people feel guilty for feeling that way. So really, and also trying to get them to understand what is realistic, and to encourage them to take time to do things that will reduce their stress, go for a walk, pray, whatever it is that they do in order to reduce that. Encouraging their participation in treatment plans, like if somebody was at a facility or at a place that there was some sort of a treatment plan, offer reassurance and compliment their efforts. And so, just really, having that. And it is known that just providing education about dementia is really helpful. And this ties into what Hope was talking about in the beginning. I think the biggest thing for me is having families get a good diagnosis so that they kind of know what their journey is going to look like. So it's the journey is very different from a true Alzheimer's to vascular dementia to, Lewy bodies dementia. We should know what we're dealing with and become educated about that. And that's one of the things that we really try to do for people at our office so they understand, what's happening ahead. What is that journey going to look like? Offering caregiver support groups, support services, and offering suggesting for visiting, encourage them to stay connected to all the support and stuff within their life. But it's hard. I know we tell people this, and they just don't feel like they have time or they don't feel like they can do it. And so it's something that I think we have to keep saying and keep offering to them. But this talks about the impact of this stress. There's no doubt that chronic stress impacts our overall health. There's no doubt about that. And so if I have inadequate sleep, I have poor nutrition, emotional distress, it starts this cycle that really does alter the chemicals within our brain. Which can alter our health moving forward. What makes us successful as a dementia care provider? I thought it was interesting that it talks here about having high self-esteem because I think a lot of times people are double guessing themselves. They don't know what to do. They feel helpless. Having patience, flexibility, creativity, being open-minded, all of this, is really helpful. A sense of self-responsibility, a willingness to learn and change. And, I think in all caregiving, this is really important. Really defining what it is that you can do, for your loved one and drawing those boundaries. And again, my mom doesn't have dementia, but she has had a chronic, very debilitating back problem for years. And my brother and I have had to meander that. You know, we've had to figure that out. And, you know, our most recent is she's also a little stubborn. and we've had to, you know, we've had to figure that out. But like for me, as far as like the boundaries, you know, my mom wants to take a shower every day. The facility that she's at, that I happen to be one of the owners, give showers twice a week. Okay. So if she wants it every day, which we could argue, should she have it every day given skin breakdown, given her age? But what I've been able to do is say, Mom, I'll be there Tuesdays and Saturdays. You can depend on me. And I worked with the facility to get them to do it Sunday and Thursday. So I think that's pretty good. And that's what I'm able to do. And then I just have to release myself from what I can't do. I can't feel bad about, you know, Wednesday. And I do. Tomorrow morning, I'll get up and I'll know that my mom's probably trying to give herself a bath because she won't listen because she's stubborn. Now I have to tell you too, we're starting to see some dementia. And I have to say, I've gotten a lot more patience because she may not remember. But I think it is important, you know, understanding what it is we can do. And what options people have as far as hiring caregivers, those types of things moving forward. So the chapter starts out talking about caregivers and how to be successful. And they're in here kind of making a connection. If you read these slides together, they're making a connection that some caregivers who aren't successful, but are very well-meaning, may end up becoming the abusers or those people that are doing neglect. And that's true in my experience of having done this for many years, is that some people are really doing the best they can do. And the disease is just hard. It's too long. It's too much. And the people may not have a lot of financial resources. They, you know, even for their own lives to make different decisions. So it was a Massachusetts survey that found that 75% of abuse sightings, that's what's reported, the abuser lived with the victim, and 86% of the abusers were relatives of the victims. They found that 81% of the, there was another study done that found very similar, that 81% of abusers were relatives. And I think the interesting thing here is they also found that 58% of the abusers were females. I think that's because so many more of the caregivers are females to begin with. Certainly there are male caregivers. My husband was one of them for his dad, ended up doing a lot more than his sisters did. Part of it was that we had a life that he was able to do that and make himself available. So again, this is kind of going over again, who are the abusers, but it kind of comes out in these surveys that it could be son, daughters, husbands, granddaughters. So just family members in general. But what's finding is that they're saying that if they went farther and said, why was this abuse? There was typically some other form of stress with that caregiver. So clearly we have alcoholism and drug addiction, you know, 28%. And that I see that. I see the mom who, you know, has lived alone, and all of a sudden we have an alcoholic child who moves back home because financially they have to and becomes an abuser. I feel like that's a little bit different than the caregiver who is so stressed out, they start to rely on alcohol to help them through the process, and that creates an addiction. But either way, some sort of long-term medical complaint, so they don't feel good. Long-term financial stress. They're holding on to their jobs and trying to caregive because they feel like they have to. It's not in this, but if you look at the statistics about people who are caregivers for those with dementia, giving up their jobs, giving up a promotion, taking a simpler job, it is overwhelming the amount of people who will end up making that decision. And that has a long-term financial impact. It's not just the money you made that year, it's the opportunity that was lost moving forward. And when they talk about abuse, they're coming down here that it's basically there's some psychological stresses, but there's also economic stress that is part of this. So one of our signs that a caregiver themselves is burning out, withdrawing, themselves feeling depressed, guilty, abusing others, needing excessive amounts of alcohol or caffeine, getting easily irritated. And so in this situation where I see it more sometimes is I have a caregiver child who has done everything to help their parent, and now they're burnt out. And we're talking about a facility, and I'm sure many on you have seen this. The kid from out of town flies home and says, "You're not putting mom in a facility." Well, that might be the absolute best place for mom. The care and the socialization might be phenomenal. The access to psychological, at least where I live, sometimes you can get better access to psychological care within a facility. But we see that. So when we have a caregiver burnout, I would say for me as an attorney, I'm often trying to be on the side of helping that caregiver. Sometimes that happens with, we have families who have to come into our office, kind of have to talk about this. And I'm sure all of you within facilities see this even on admission, or people trying to advocate, make sure they get good care. This is talking about the fact that people who have dementia are really able to be abused easier because they can't really tell the story. So if somebody steals their check, they may not know. If they say that happened, somebody may not listen to them. And that's always a concern. Typically, they're talking in here, this is in the northeast of the US. Typically, what we're seeing in support groups is maybe a more upper class neighborhood, white African American. Caregivers are mostly women caring for men, more than 1 year of caring for a loved one, and they're exhausted and don't ask for help. And I know a lot of what we do at our office is try to give some sort of resources. this is saying if you're trying to help a caregiver, don't just say, "Call me if you need any help," because they're not going to. That's true of so many things, not just dementia, but a friend that, is diagnosed with cancer or something. We already talked about people being burnt out, being exhausted. So giving them a meal or doing something to make them know that you care for them is really important. Just find out what they need and go do it for them. Now this chapter moves over to physical abuse examples, and it shows all of the different examples, including force feeding. And that happens sometimes when people are in a hurry and they're worried. Hope talked about somebody who is wandering and the amount of calories that they can get rid of in a day and how much they do need to be fed. There in that situation, I'm always one for me. I'm always one, give them a milkshake. Give them what they, let's take some time to figure out what they like. And there could be other people who feel differently. Maybe having the best nutrition is more important. But I mean, I've always thought there's milk in a milkshake so that it has to be good for me. But I know at the facility that we had, that's actually one of the things we did. We just started giving a gentleman a milkshake. He loved chocolate milk and he loved chocolate ice cream. And that really helped him gain some weight back. Now, of course, we still did ensure we still had him eat his meals. This was an addition too. A lot of times older people can't eat huge amounts at one time. They have to have more smaller meals sprayed out. This is giving examples of psychological abuse. Berating, ignoring, ridiculing, cursing, threats of punishment. In my job as an attorney, I've been often, especially early in my career, I was court appointed often in these situations to kind of decide what should happen. And one of the things we always have to take our step back about is it doesn't excuse it, but and we have to look at it through the lens of their family and how their families always interacted with each other. Because somebody may be talking about like maybe they are yelling very loud language, but maybe that's their typical. I'm not saying that like in a facility setting, obviously we have to think about other people, but at home to understand the dynamics that are involved, some of it people may have to be retrained how they typically interacted with each other. We want to think about that.